Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, October 6th, 2022. This is the 24th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I'm joined by Glenn Allen, a board member and representative of the Free Expression Foundation. All right, Glenn Allen, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm well, John, and thanks for inviting me back on.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. It's great to talk to you once again. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this interview. There is so much going on in the world right now. But today, I think we're going to focus primarily on some domestic issues. We're going to focus on the organization that you're involved with, the Free Expression Foundation. It is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And to get started, can you kind of give us a brief background on the organization and maybe elaborate on its mission and purpose?
Sure. Well, let's go back about 5 or 6 years when I was doxxed by the odious and hateful SPLC, and it was a pretty miserable experience. But it made me sensitive to the fact that there are people out there who are mistreated by these hard left organizations who don't have lawyers. I am a lawyer, so I was able to mount a complaint against the SPLC, but I felt all the isolation and all the trauma that almost anyone feels when these forces come down on you simply for having a view that they disapprove of. And so I thought, you know, I've got to try to help people who are in similar situations. And so with working with Paul Angel and Chris Petherick from AFP, we created the Free Expression Foundation in 2018. And I'll give you some examples of what I'm trying to do, and I could give you the longer version. But I recall reading somewhere that there was a young man named Andrew Dodson who took his life after Charlottesville. He just felt he was doxxed, and he just felt so isolated. He felt no one was looking out for him.
Yeah, I remember that case. Yeah, I actually wrote about it in American Free Press when it happened. Yeah, very tragic story, of course, that very few people know about.
Yeah, and I don't want, if I can help it, I don't want that to happen to anyone. I don't want anyone who's doxxed, who loses their job, often loses their friends, to feel that they have no one in the world. I want to help those kind of people. So that's kind of the essence of what the Free Expression Foundation is. But more generically, we're trying to help people who've been harmed economically, morally, or legally from the exercise or attempted exercise of the rights of free expression, including under the First Amendment. And yeah, we've had a few successes, but not nearly as much as we need to have in this horrible cancel culture, left-wing, totalitarian environment that we're steadily moving into.
Yeah, boy, that's exactly what it is. It's a form of tyranny that might be unmatched in history, frankly. I mean, looking at things objectively, like, we are living in some really incredible times, and I got to tip my hat. I mean, you have been through a lot just, you know, with your doxing, which we've talked about in previous conversations. So setting up this organization, I think, is really important. I just pulled a couple quotes directly from the website. And by the way, the website is freeexpressionfoundation.org, and I will have a link to that when I post this podcast program. But the organization is dedicated to providing moral, legal, and financial support to those who have been victims of the potent social forces that have chosen the un-American path of monitoring, intimidation, and destruction. And that is exactly what these hostile organizations and hostile activists, journalists engage in. This is the type of behavior that they engage in. They try to target people. They are very malicious. They are trying to actively harm people that have a different set of political values, a different set of political or historical opinions or perspectives, for example. And in many, many cases, they make that very clear that they are out to harm and cause problems for the people that they are targeting.
That's certainly true. The SPLC, as you may know, Mr. Potok expressly said, I guess in a moment of candor, we're out there to destroy these people.
Yeah.
We're not out there to advocate for First Amendment dialogue. We're out there to destroy them.
Well, that was kind of the purpose of the whole Unite the Right lawsuit involving that Integrity First for America, which is another topic that we've discussed in the past. I mean, this was probably like a case study in a slap lawsuit, you know, where it was specifically designed to prevent people and intimidate others from engaging in their constitutionally protected First Amendment rights.
That's absolutely right. It's a form of lawfare that is funded by very wealthy people. And as you say, it's not a matter that they politely disagree. It's more a matter that they want to destroy the dissident right. And they're using money to do it. And yeah, Roberta Kaplan raised, I don't know, $25 million, and she got these verdicts, although they weren't a complete success. But she certainly succeeded in making people's lives miserable who had views she didn't like. And I, to this day, am appalled that the judge could not see that he got hung up on legal technicalities and didn't see the big picture.
Yeah, I agree. Well, another aim of the organization is to provide legal, financial, and moral support for persons and entities that have suffered or are at risk of suffering legal, financial, or social harm as a result of the exercise, attempted exercise, or intention to exercise their rights of free expression, including their rights under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So, I mean, obviously this is sort of what you've been elaborating on, but I think the purpose and mission of this organization is very, very important, especially when we have all of these very hostile forces operating in society and today and largely controlling society, including the judicial system itself.
Oh, I wish that weren't true, John. I went to law school because I respected judges and I respected the system, and I've tried to keep myself from being cynical, but I have seen so many miscarriages of justice that it really appalls me. And I have moments of thinking that this system is not really that much better than being an advocate for free speech in communist Romania in 1958 or something. But I am a lawyer. I fancy myself a pretty competent lawyer, and I'm going to try to help all I can. And there are occasional successes that buoy my spirits. But even if it weren't, you know, we've got to put up a fight. Our founding fathers gave us the framework for real freedom, and we shouldn't just throw it away.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you had sent out an email last month with some updates and some new initiatives that you are pursuing with the Free Expression Foundation. The first project centers around providing legal, financial, and moral support to those facing charges as a result of their participation in the protests on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol, which have been very dishonestly characterized as an insurrection by the Democrats and by the mass media, and even some Republicans cowardly go along with this like totally absurd characterization of what actually happened that day. So this is a recent initiative, and it's something you've been following, obviously, from the beginning. And in the email you sent out, you talk about the treatment of some of these people that have been arrested or charged with crimes, and you describe it as scandalous, a stain on the honor of the American legal system. There have been excessive charges filed against a lot of these people, denials of bail. They've been mistreated in prison. We've seen all sorts of reports of that, especially in that DC jail. So it's really quite a travesty of justice, to say the least. And I know this is an initiative that you're sort of spearheading. It's very, very important. There's been a lot of reporting on the situation, the charges that a lot of these people are facing and just their overall situation. So you want to talk about this first initiative to kind of get this started?
Sure. Let me back up and just make a comment about My perception, as I said, I got in a tussle with the SPLC. And after that, I was involved in the Charlottesville, helping file amicus briefs on behalf of some of the Rise Above movement people in Charlottesville. And then in January 6th, and you know, I just was commenting to myself the other day that there's something in common. And that is that these media, these journalists, these advocates for leftist views, and unfortunately the judiciary, they minimize the misdeeds of the left and they exaggerate the misdeeds of the dissident right. And that sums up the SPLC. I mean, they have this hate map that they blow up every year to try to exaggerate the so-called hate that's going around, and they ignore anything from the left that's any criminal activity. And and we know in Charlottesville from the Heafy report that it's not exactly the case that these Antifa and other counter-protesters were well-behaved. We know they weren't, or the police, but they no charges were ever brought against them. And January 6th is just the exemplification of that. I mean, there were so many people there, and I think there's 680 charges, and I'm not saying there weren't some bad actors who did some foolish and inappropriate things, but there's so many that were just there spurred by old-time patriotism. And yes, there were about 40 of them that ended up in the D.C. correctional facility, and the conditions there were disgraceful. I sent out letters to them trying to – I'm not a criminal defense lawyer, John. My background is in civil litigation, but I wanted to be helpful, so I did send out letters. And I got some responses. I could read from one. This person is going to trial very quickly, so I think within a short time. So I probably will use a pseudonym for this person. But
please do. Yeah, if you don't mind, you know, obviously there might be some information that you'd prefer to keep private. But yeah, if you have anything you can share, that would be great. I was actually going to ask you, you know, what sort of communication or involvement that you've actually had with some of these people.
Yeah. Well, I got this letter from, let's call this person James. It's a 6-page letter, but he says, he describes how his, my rights have been severely violated since my arrest. First, my bond was denied due to the damage of a door that occurred 21 minutes before I arrived. They said the damage was an act of terrorism, but they also admitted I didn't do the damage. Nonetheless, I was denied bail. I have also been medically neglected. Prior to January 6th, I sustained a broken arm and broken ribs. My arms and ribs were still broken when I was arrested. My splint was taken away and replaced with an ACE bandage. When I transferred jails, the bandage was taken away, and I had to cradle my broken arm with no medical attention at all for a month. The U.S. Marshals handcuffed my broken wrist, causing severe pain. By the time I got to the D.C. jail, they did an X-ray and found it was still broken and would now require surgery to fix. To this day, I still cannot use it. And a year and a half later, I'm often in agony. I have suffered cruel and unusual punishment as a result of the medical neglect. The medical supervisor who took away my bandage, I informed her of my injury and signed a form to give her access to my medical records. When she refused to treat me, I went 2 days in severe pain before I got in an argument. I admit I wasn't nice. I yelled, I cried, and I called her names. She responded by having me stripped naked, put in a glass cell that was freezing cold, with lights on, left on 24/7. I demanded an attorney, and they laughed at me, said I was on suicide watch, and I didn't get to talk to the attorney. After 4 days of freezing pain, naked, humiliated, I resorted to using baby carrots to write on the cell floor, "I'm not suicidal." I simply got in an argument and was punished with humiliation. I could read you some more, and I will.
This is almost just like unbelievable. This is like some of the stuff you'd hear about, like how some of these detainees in like the war on terrorism were being handled at like Guantanamo Bay, and like Bagram Air Base, how they were being tortured, indefinitely detained. I mean, no trial set. You know, you're basically just thrown in the gulag, thrown in the dungeon, or thrown naked in you know, an empty cell, a, you know, freezing cold cell. I mean, this is outrageous.
Isn't it?
Yeah. And yet this is how, frankly, I mean, from what I can tell anyways, the vast majority of these people were just good-hearted American patriots that had concerns about the election results.
That's my perception, too.
Yeah.
As I said, there were some bad actors. And I've never subscribed to the fact that all of, to the proposition that they were all plants from the government. I mean, there were some people who really shouldn't have done what they did. But
yeah,
I just 90%
totally
of them were traditional American patriots who felt their government had become totally corrupt, and they got caught up in the, you know, in that feeling we're doing something. That feeling. Yeah. That, apropos of that, John, let me read a little more here.
Sure.
Since we've been incarcerated, we've, all the January 6 detainees have been targeted with politically and racially motivated harassment by the staff. We were routinely called honkies, crackers, Trump motherfuckers, white boys, and been told that we wish you went to the other side of the jail. They'd stab you quick. No joke, the staff wanted us stabbed to death. One defendant disobeyed an officer, and they pepper sprayed the entire unit and left us in our cells choking on mace. We were singing God Bless America, and the officer came up yelling, fuck America, repeatedly, and threatened violence if we didn't shut up. One of the other January 6th person was beaten nearly to death a few cells down from me over a roll of toilet paper. Another was beaten for singing the national anthem. The guards trashed our cells three times in a single day, less than 24 hours after Congressman Marjorie Taylor Greene exposed some of the goings-on in the facility. Our cells were trashed in retribution. We had guards leave us in our cells for days at a time because they said we were terrorists. And then this person talks about how this person has been in solitary confinement for 231 days. 231 days. I think I wanted to read something. This is apropos of your remark about the motivation. It says this person had fought in Afghanistan and was a veteran and a firefighter. I love my country. I was not at January 6th to overthrow the government or to use force to prevent, hinder, or delay any laws. I went to protect people from Antifa thugs because I had concerns about election integrity. I got swept up in the moment and ended up protesting. Free and fair elections are the bedrock of our democracy, and I wanted my voice heard, my grievances redressed, and I peacefully assembled to do so, nothing more. So now I may never see my home again. Why did I even bother? Nothing was accomplished. And now my country hates me. It was a total waste. Yeah,
wow,
you can
That's pretty depressing to hear.
It is. You know, this is an idealistic person. And I know on another conversation with another one, this defendant too, we'll call him, his girlfriend said, you know, we felt like we were put on a lifeboat in the middle of the ocean and nobody cares and nobody's coming for us. And I think we got to try to do something to reach those people. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's certainly a very noble effort because they have been totally disregarded and forgotten about, even by Trump himself. And I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, I wanted to ask your general thoughts on what happened on January 6th. And you've more or less addressed that. I mean, it sounds like we're pretty much in agreement. I mean, I think that there were overwhelming numbers of very genuine people that were concerned about the integrity of the election. They were Trump supporters, good-hearted American patriots, essentially. I think that there were certainly a number of bad actors, including perhaps government informants or, you know, agent provocateurs, these sorts of things that played a key role in instigating and sort of organizing this, what turned into be like largely a media spectacle. I mean, that's essentially what it was, in my opinion, anyways. So it sounds like you basically agree with me in that assessment. But I got to ask you, what role did Trump play in all this? How do you view his subsequent handling of the fallout from this event? I mean, in my mind, it's scandalous the role that he played and sort, you know, how he kind of threw these people under the bus after the fact and is only just now even talking about it again and talking about some of the injustices that have been perpetrated against these people who were diehard loyal fans of his that he basically left out to dry.
Well, you make a good point, John. I guess we have to put it in context. I don't think his behavior was appropriate at all, but compared to how horribly they've been treated by others, I suppose I can find snippets of good in Trump. I mean, he's talked about pardons, which he should do. I mean, for example, these people in this D.C. facility have been denied bail for a year and a half. So essentially, they've been incarcerated without trial for a year and a half for basically often just trespassing, boisterous trespassing. I do know some people who were at the Trump rally, and they said his speech was typical bombastic Trump speech. He got the crowd worked up. I do feel he should have taken some responsibility for that. According to my sources, he never did encourage them to. I don't know. He might have made some general statements. So I can see why he perhaps was a little cautious about condoning everything that happened. But yeah, I don't know. Trump's an odd character. I've never quite been able to figure him out. I mean, he does and says things that sometimes I admire. I mean, he takes the fake media for what they are. And he speaks his mind, which is a comfort. But boy, he does some things that perplex me. I guess the only hope is to hope he gets reelected and he carries through on those pardons that he's promised.
Yeah, well, I have very little faith in our elections anymore, and haven't had much faith in him for quite some time now. But yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, I agree. You know, he does say some good things from time to time, but then 9 times out of 10, it seems like his actions lack. Like he'll talk a good game, but then totally fail to follow through with anything. But anyways, I don't want to get sort of sidetracked by talking about Trump. I was just curious, you know, what your assessment of like what role he played in all of this and sort of like the subsequent handling of the event. Have you been following any current developments? Like, I know there's this trial against some of the top leaders with the Oath Keepers. Mm-hmm. Have you been following any of those developments? I just read a story the other day that the federal prosecutors are seeking to keep the identities of their confidential human sources and their cooperating witnesses a secret. And this is, you know, just cannon fodder for people who are alleging that there were undercover informants and operatives that played a key role in setting this whole situation up and instigating this quote-unquote insurrection, right?
Yeah. I have been following it to some degree, and I do know it is. They're right in the middle of the trial now. As you know, there are about, 12 to 15 people who are members of the Oath Keepers. And they're linked together, unfortunately, by conspiracy allegations, which are very, very problematic in my judgment. As you know, John, the difficulty with the unfairness of conspiracy allegations is if they can establish a conspiracy, then you're liable for the misdeeds of everybody else who's in the conspiracy. And I happen to know that I followed it enough to know that some of the people did very little. So the government, of course, is focusing on establishing that there was a conspiracy by, you know, these communication lines to show that they might have said something imprudent, like, okay, I'm with you, or let's go, or something like that. And they're using that to, you know, use their conspiracy allegations. One thing that I was a little disappointed to find, actually, is it does seem that some of there are various counsel for the various Oath Keeper defendants, but they seem to be trying to blame others. And I understand the pressure that's on an attorney. If they can't blame the government, maybe it makes sense to try to blame somebody else who was there. And I do know that one of them has turned against some of the other people who were at the January 6th event and said, well, arguing that there may well have been an intent to stop the election results, but it wasn't the Oath Keepers who did it. It was these other people. Again,
Yeah,
I don't
there was
press
a.
my attorneys to try to do everything they can, but it's sorrowful to me to see them splitting up like that, or seeming to split up.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, I agree with you, and I think it's these guys are in a very, very difficult position, and I think obviously many of them have been pressured and basically intimidated and threatened by these federal prosecutors. I remember back in March, I wrote a report about the one of the leaders of the Alabama chapter of the Oath Keepers, a guy named Joshua James. He did plead guilty to one count of seditious conspiracy and one count of obstructing an official proceeding. And in part of the plea deal that he entered into, he was going to basically cooperate with the prosecution of other Oath Keepers and other people caught up in this quote unquote seditious conspiracy. So, I mean, you know, these guys are in a very difficult position, but I don't think it's going to work out very well for anybody cooperating with these, you know, federal prosecutors who, again, are just as malicious as private organizations like the SPLC or some of these very activist, left-wing, Antifa-type journalists that you see out there doxing people and trying to get people fired and organizing these lynch mobs, essentially, to target their political opponents.
It's all right. Everything you said is correct, John. And let's imagine the pressure that's on these people incarcerated in the DC facility to take a plea or to cooperate themselves after they've lived in a virtual torturous environment for 18 months. I mean, you can imagine, and feeling abandoned by the outside world. The temptation to just cave in and say, well, whatever you want. I know that these are strong people, but boy, it's going to take an enormously strong person not to do it. And I have heard reports that, as you could expect, I mean, there's some people who are now becoming some of these are becoming suspicious of others because they don't know if they're going to inform or not, or they're going to. And it's painful to see that because there had been, I think, some pretty strong solidarity. Most of the January 6 people were kept in the same area, so I think they bonded to some degree. But the pressures to cooperate or to take a plea are sort of putting pressures on that, I think.
Yeah, no, I yep, I totally agree. And as you mentioned, Dodson, I believe was his name, the young man who, after being doxxed and harassed after Charlottesville, ended up committing suicide. There have been at least one or two other individuals that were tied up in the whole January 6th protest that also went on to commit suicide because of the federal pressure and the media slanders and the media coverage and just all the pressure that's been built up on them, either socially or legally, you know, with the feds coming after them. So it's really had a very negative impact on a lot of people, a lot of good-hearted people, you know, very, you know, frankly, truly peaceful protesters, unlike the Black Lives Matters and Antifa terrorists that we saw, you know, unleashed across the country in 2020, and I mean even to this day.
Oh my gosh, that's so
Yeah.
the disparity is just mind-boggling. Well, I know one person who committed suicide. That was Matthew Perna, PERNA.
Yeah, yep, exactly. That's exactly
He
who I
said he
was
was a very
thinking of.
sensitive guy, and he just couldn't endure it anymore. I don't know of any others, but of course Ashley Babbitt. We know how she was treated, and talk about disparity. I mean, here's a 110-pound woman who was unarmed in the presence of several policemen pushing through a window, and the policeman shot and killed her. And our government decided that there was nothing actionable or inappropriate about that.
Right, and if I'm not mistaken, the officer who allegedly shot her was a black man. So we have a black man shooting an unarmed white woman. I mean, could you imagine if the races were reversed? I know that's kind of like a cliche comment, but you know, we Derek Chauvin, for example, I mean, is a prime example where a black criminal that just took a bunch of drugs and overdosed and died. I mean, and he's treated as a murderer.
No,
It's
it's a good
outrageous.
comparison. It's a good comparison with Chauvin. I mean, what he's, I don't know, we got 40 years or something, and this guy didn't get charged with anything.
Nothing. Yeah, he's well, not only did he not get charged, but he's portray it as this hero, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah. And they refused to disclose his identity for, I don't know, 3 months or something. But apropos of Matthew Cherna and Ashley Babbitt, mentioned something to you may know already, John, but there's something out there called the American Freedom Project, or is it the Patriot Freedom Project? I guess it is. It was created by Cynthia Hughes. Are you familiar with that?
I just looked it up. I see the website here. Yeah, patriotfreedomproject.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is kind of providing financial moral support for January 6th defendants.
Yeah.
Yep.
She was pretty successful, but I know at one time, and they may do it again, with the help of a commendable source, they had a scholarship named after, they had a Perna scholarship and a actually Babbitt scholarship, but for $5,000 for law students just to write about it. Unfortunately, no one claimed it, but I think it's coming back up. But I greatly admire that. I mean, it's one way to remember these people, at least to create a scholarship in there. And that's one of the many good things that Patriot Freedom Project is doing. Just so you know, I initially volunteered to work for them, but that was about the same time that NPR, you know, Cynthia Hughes is, I don't know her background, but she was quite successful in raising money. I think she raised $800,000 or something. And I have no reason to believe other than she used it honestly to try to help pay for attorneys and things. But NPR, of course, didn't like that. They didn't like the fact that some January 6 people were getting support and did an article on her. And anyway, they've never contacted me after that. I'm a little bit of a radioactive myself, as you know.
So they basically like intimidated this woman with this media hit piece that was involved in setting up this organization?
Well, I mean, she's too strong, but they let her know she's being watched, you know. And
yeah.
And these are the same people who never watched Roberta Kaplan when she raised $25 million for the United, you know, or the SPLC when it raises $500 million with these hate maps and things. Where are these people, you know, suddenly let's trace the source of this money and see if it's all legit. But this poor woman raises, you know, $800,000 and NPR makes it a major point to, you know, examine it.
Yeah. Well, that's typical. That's exactly how these, you know, mainstream mass media outlets work. And NPR, think about it. This is a publicly funded news outlet that's maliciously targeting just an average American citizen trying to help defendants out in a very, frankly, scandalous legal situation. I mean,
yeah. Let me mention something else about that. Apropos of that, I think Cynthia Hughes is the aunt of Timothy Hale Cusinelli. And I wrote an article for Free Expression Foundation on Timothy Hale Cusinelli. He just had a trial and he got convicted. He was facing 10 years. He got 10 years plus 3 years supervised probation. A lot of things about that whole prosecution appalled me, but he was one of the people who's detained in the DC facility. And that's what spurred, I think, Cynthia Hughes to get involved. But, you know, I looked into it a little bit and I was trying to understand what was going on with why Hale Cusinelli was not given bail. I'm just going to quote a little bit from the article I wrote. Here were some facts about Hale Cusinelli. On January 6, 2021, he traveled to Washington to attend the Stop the Steal rally. He had worked as a private security guard with security clearance and was a sergeant in the Army Reserves with no incidents of violence or dereliction of duty. He wore a suit and tie, and he did not bring any weapon. He eventually made his way to the Capitol, where he entered through doors that had already been kicked open. He later admitted that he made hand gestures to urge others to advance. In a recorded conversation, Hale Cusinelli was heard to say, "It is only a matter of time before a civil war broke out along partisan lines," and that he wishes there would be a civil war. And then he quoted Jefferson. Jefferson said the tree of liberty should be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants. On January 29, 2021, he was indicted on 7 counts. After his arrest, the government interviewed 44 of his co-workers, and 34 of them described him as having extremist or radical views. And the only arrest on his record is when he used a homemade potato gun to fire frozen corn cobs at a home in a dispute over a stolen bicycle.
Look at the legal resources being used, you know, to investigate these people compared to how, again, BLM and Antifa terrorists were treated and not even investigated in many cases.
Boy, that is so true, John. They interviewed 44 people. I mean, how much
for this one guy? Yeah.
I mean, which of us could withstand if they interviewed 44 people who knew me, I'm sure they could find me quoting Thomas Jefferson or something. And what is wrong with quoting Thomas Jefferson? And I think Thomas Jefferson would be a very, very problematical guy for these left wingers at this stage of our degeneration of our culture. But yeah, he was denied bail based on that scenario I just described, and he also had ill health, and then he was prosecuted and found guilty on all counts by a DC jury, which, by the way, is very problematical for these people. I mean, you and I both know how fair a DC jury is going to be to Trump supporters or people in the dissident right. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that was another point that you made in the email newsletter that you sent out about this, about the January 6th situation. And from what I understand, a lot of these people that are locked up there, they can they even have visitors? I mean, are they getting legal counsel? I mean, you want to comment on that aspect of it as well?
Oh, sure. I'd very much like to comment on that. Once I sent my letters out, I tried to contact two of the people who had sent me letters. And one of them, we'll call him Sean. He was able to contact me through an iPad, and then they took the iPad away from him. And then he tried to call me, and he had trouble with his getting time on his phone. So I lost contact with him. I tried to come visit him, which I had done with the Charlottesville Rise Above Movement people. I just arranged a visit down there in Virginia and showed up and got to talk to them. It was extremely difficult to do that in D.C. supposedly because of COVID. They would not allow personal visits. You could only do it through these electronic means, and then they controlled that. So it just became virtually impossible for me to have a strong interaction with him. Things have worked out a little better for this guy. He was very disappointed in his public defender, and he wanted to change her. To terminate her, but he didn't have much money. But his friends desperately got enough money together so he could terminate his public defender, who, by the way, explicitly said she didn't share his views. I mean, how appropriate is that for a public defender to say that? But he hired a guy who's parenthetically has same last name as I did, and I was just looking over something that got filed yesterday to try to get him a temporary release. And it describes what his time has been like there. I might read a little, since this is public information, I might read a little bit. But a big problem was he is unable to prepare his defense because he needs to get some kind of electronic means so he can get access to a lot of the emails and things that are being used against him and that are favorable. But there's just overwhelming logistical challenges that prevent him from having any opportunity to review discovery or assist counsel or to even visit with his counsel. There have been numerous case productions, and he's just unable to get them. Let me just read a little bit from this motion that was filed by his new attorney. Even when inmates will be permitted to view evidence on evidence.com, the unpredictability of lockdowns taking place at the CTF facility will prevent this person from being able to review the hundreds of hours of video evidence and discuss what he sees and what he thinks with counsel prior to his trial date. These lockdowns typically involve 22-hour periods when inmates cannot leave their cells. Even with the easing of conditions relating to COVID-19, the continuing rise of new variants, makes drastic lockdown and quarantine measures necessary, makes any kind of reasonable assurance of consistent access to discovery or counsel untenable at best. Further, at this time and under the conditions of incorporation, his contribution to his defense is severely curtailed, as communication between counsel and this person is at the mercy of the scheduling of the CTF. There's no timely communication, only to frustrating efforts on counsel to try to contact him. I could go on, but I mean, it's just, so there's the enormous problem of being able to work on his own defense there. And there's the problem that his mental health is he has a child that they haven't allowed him to see in 18 months, and it's weighing on him. And that's something that they've been ignoring.
I don't understand how anybody could defend this as any form of like legitimate justice. Yeah. This is just straight up torture. It is a straight up perversion of justice. I mean, this is political persecution.
It is. Yeah, it's something out of a Solzhenitsyn novel. I hope there's a Solzhenitsyn in there somewhere who can write about this. I'm appalled, John, and I hardly know. I'm having trouble saluting the flag these days when it seems to condone this, but I realize that there. I mean, I served in the army. I was a patriot, but. And I know there are good things to this country, but when I see those things, I just feel that some malicious force has taken over our judiciary, our media, and I feel it's just not my country anymore.
Yep. Well, you're right. A very subversive evil force has taken over the media and the judicial system and many other aspects of society. But it's good that you're doing what you can to stand up to it and at least try to support these prisoners. And I know that, again, is one of the main projects that you're working on. If you don't mind, I'd like to move on to the second project that you sort of outlined in your recent newsletter. And that relates to an initiative to sue Antifa groups and to hold them accountable for their many, many crimes all across the country. And it's interesting because the government regularly portrays Antifa as an idea. I think the FBI director, Christopher Wray, that's how he's described Antifa and other FBI officials in these in these hearings before congressional committees. So Antifa is this idea. It's not an organized network of criminals and terrorists. And, legitimate investigators and researchers like Andy Ngo, for example, and many others have conclusively demonstrated that Antifa networks and organizations openly coordinate, oftentimes across state lines, using mainstream social media networks like Twitter, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much all. I'm sure you're familiar with Andy Ngo and some of the work that he's done. He wrote a whole book about Antifa exposing this. Mm-hmm. And documenting how it is, in fact, this pretty well-organized, and in some instances, they openly are coordinating and networking and planning their actions openly on social media. It's really no secret. So if the government is sending, interviewing 44 witnesses of this one individual you mentioned previously, how are they not even investigating these Antifa groups? It's asinine, and it demonstrates how just totally weaponized and politically motivated the justice system is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. The specific project I have. Let me back up and say I'm not familiar with any civil suit against Antifa that has been successful. If there's one out there, I'd like to learn about it. I have been following the, Dambly versus Exu litigation that was filed against Antifa, and God bless him by a courageous attorney in New Jersey. But that recently was dismissed, the complaint. And I guess it's an open secret that judges, especially under the common law, causes of action, there's enough room in there that they can find some element that's not satisfied and dismiss it. That happened to me with my SPLC lawsuit. I think any impartial observer would say my complaint was valid and legitimate, but the judges decided they found something that didn't measure up to what they wanted. But So
cases like this, like your case with the SPLC, for example, and this other case against this Antifa I believe it was just one individual who was involved in like doxing people and stuff like that. These cases are thrown out not really on the merits of the case, but more on like technicalities. Is that a fair characterization?
Let me just put some framework on it. There are kind of four stages to litigation, right? You file the complaint, and then there's something called a motion to dismiss, in which the defendant will say, even assuming everything that's said is true, it doesn't state a legal cause of action. And then if it gets past the motion to dismiss, then there's discovery, you know, depositions and document review. And then you have a summary judgment phase, and that point is the defendant will say, you know, no reasonable jury could look at this evidence and find for the plaintiff. And then the judge will rule on that. And if the plaintiff survives summary judgment, then it goes to trial, of course. But the motion to dismiss is supposed to be a very favorable to the plaintiff. But I mean, recently a Supreme Court has said if it's just some fantastical thing that's incredible, if I say that, you know, Martians are coming to they caused me to be poisoned last night or something that's just not believable, the judge has discretion to throw it out, even at the motion to dismiss standard. It's called the Twombly credibility standard, plausibility standard, but it's misused, and that was misused against me. The federal judge held it was not plausible on a motion to dismiss that the SPLC would bribe somebody to attempt to find information to dox them. I not only find it very credible, I find it incredible that anyone would doubt that. But that's how it was thrown out on me, and that's the room that's at the play. And that's something similar has happened in this Dambly versus Exidu case. The judge, you know, found some element that didn't pass, you know, credibility standards. The project I'm working on, it may have some of these common law elements that allow the judge to make these kind of rulings. But in this case, Antifa had infiltrated a certain organization and gotten access to their computer. And there's something called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act that was passed about 30 years ago that has some very definite elements. And it's a little hard to, you know, twist your way around them. And I think that they were satisfied in this case. So I'm, you know, despite my increasing cynicism about the fairness of the judiciary system, I think it's going to be pretty hard for them to get around these elements. So I'm hopeful to hold, maybe for the first time, I don't know, to get past a motion to dismiss and suing an Antifa.
Yeah, well, let's hope so, certainly. I'll keep my fingers crossed. I do know of one case where Antifa members are actually being prosecuted, and I think I sent you a link to it. I don't know if you follow the story. It's actually a story out of San Diego, California, where a group of Antifa terrorists, essentially, were involved with attacks on Trump supporters on a beach, basically. There was a Trump rally in January of 2021, and a group of violent Antifa attacked these people. And so I think it's either 10 or 11 total have been charged in this, you know, and they're being charged criminally for these actions. Let me just read briefly. This is from the postmillennial.com. The headline is San Diego trans Antifa member. And of course, these people are always, you know, some like the biggest freaks you will ever encounter. This individual is a transsexual, apparently. So San Diego trans Antifa member pleads guilty for Pacific Beach attacks. And this is just one individual in a network of, I think, 10 or 11 that are actually charged. And it says here, a 38-year-old Antifa member and career criminal in San Diego is the first to be convicted over a violent Antifa conspiracy to attack Donald Trump supporters and beachgoers at Pacific Beach in January 2021. The guy's name is Eric Locke of San Ysidro, California, and he admitted to conspiracy to riot, assaulting multiple persons, and unlawfully using tear gas as a weapon, plus other felonies in court on Wednesday. And this was, it says on Wednesday, this was like last week. No, it was, I'm sorry, it was the end of September, so like September 28th. Let me see what else here. So basically, this individual pleaded guilty, entered into a plea agreement. I believe he or she is going to wind up spending 5 years in jail. The report also says in June of this year, a secret grand jury indicted Yock and 10 other alleged Antifa members accused of being part of a network of violent cells in Southern California that planned and carried out brutal attacks during a riot in Pacific Beach, California, on January 9th of 2021. Video recorded at the riots showed the mob in black block assaulting multiple victims with weapons. Trump supporters, miners, a photojournalist, and a man and his dog walking on the beach were all hurt during the attacks. Multiple weapons and firearms were seized from suspects during executed search warrants. So, at least in San Diego, the local prosecutors, the local district attorney, is actually pursuing criminal charges and has basically uncovered this network of very well-organized and coordinated Antifa activists that engaged in this conspiracy to attack Trump supporters. Now, if San Diego County prosecutors can pursue an investigation of this nature, why can't other prosecutors across the country pursue similar investigations? I mean, I was just looking at Andy Ngo's Twitter feed earlier this morning. And in Portland, Oregon, of course, this is very common in Portland, where Antifa terrorists will go out and attack private businesses for hosting community events with police officers, for example, or any other number of events that Antifa does not approve of. And in a recent case, just earlier this week, a business was totally vandalized, had all the windows broken out. The building itself, the business itself, was basically ransacked and destroyed. And you have these Antifa people on Twitter openly celebrating and sort of, you know, essentially celebrating this act of terrorism. And meanwhile, the Portland police are issuing press releases saying that they don't have any leads. They don't know who's responsible for this. No arrests have been made. You know, it's just outrageous that this continues to go on, and the police act like they have no – what do you mean you don't have any leads? Just go talk to Andy Ngo. He already figured out who's, you know, basically celebrating and sponsoring this sort of activity.
Yeah. Well, there was a prosecution. I thought there were charges brought in Portland a year or two ago against 90 Antifa, and the last I read, not a single one of them had been – I think half of them had been – dismissed, and the other half had served light sentences like community service or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's very, very common. If any of these far left radicals and terrorists are actually arrested and prosecuted, 9 times out of 10, it seems like their cases are dismissed, or eventually dismissed, or as you mentioned, they receive very, very light sentences. Mm-hmm. Just comparing and contrasting the way the January 6th defendants, for example, have been treated, where the entire legal system is thrown at them. You know, they have unlimited resources to investigate these people who, again, were basically involved in a peaceful protest at the Capitol. Yeah. Meanwhile, these sorts of people, these Antifa criminals, essentially aren't even investigated at all.
No, you almost feel like you're an occupied country. It goes beyond, you know, as I said, just people who disagree with our opinions. It's people who want dissident right people dead with no rights, or maybe that's too extreme. But yeah, when I first learned about the San Diego, I didn't pay much attention to it. I thought it was a federal prosecution, but as you say, it's a state prosecution, which shows you, how corrupt the feds have become. I mean, there
exactly.
might be
some yep.
isolated state prosecutor out there that doesn't feed from the same Kool-Aid, but the federal system, I mean, it's corrupt from top to bottom, it seems to me. to this day, I regret I didn't get on the other. I went to the sentencing for Michael Marcellus and the other Rise Above Movement guys, and the prosecutors put up all these videos of all these Antifa, which showed, you know, the kind of scuffles that the Rise Above Movement people had gotten in. And then the conclusion was you need to, you know, really throw the book at these horrible Rise Above Movement, which the judge did, gave him 3 years in prison. But I wanted to get on the elevator. I didn't quite make it with this prosecutor and say, okay, those same videos you showed the Antifa fighting. Why aren't you prosecuting them?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and I mean, objectively looking at, you know, just doing any sort of basic investigation into these cases, like the Charlottesville situation or what happened with the Rise Above Movement, if you look at the videos of the, you know, the fights or the scuffles, it's always the other side attacking the conservatives or right wingers or like the Rise Above Movement, for example, not the other way around.
That's true.
You know, so I mean, it's so just like even objectively looking at this, it's just so outrageous. And in such a politically motivated system, I mean, certainly at the federal level, as you're explaining. But yeah, it's just outrageous. And speaking of Michael Marcellus, that's actually the final project that I was going to mention that you're sort of spearheading here. And you're hoping to provide legal assistance and potential litigation against UCLA, where, from what I understand, he was actually pursuing a PhD in aerospace engineering.
That's right.
And after this whole situation, you know, being prosecuted as a result of these scuffles with Antifa at, you know, in Charlottesville and other places in California, he was basically kicked out of the school essentially for his political activities, for his political perspectives. I think you could make a strong case.
Yeah.
Do you want to kind of just briefly give us a background on this?
Add this to the insanity of our system. I mean, Mike Marcellus is an upright, decent young man. I admire him a great deal. But he was 1 year from a PhD in aerospace engineering at UCLA when actually he came back. You know, they didn't prosecute these guys for about a year after Charlottesville. And that was when some people ghost wrote the indictment and fed it to the prosecutor. Some of these New York nonprofits did that. But so he was, you know, pulled out of his house and with all this shock and awe that the FBI likes to do with dozens of FBI agents and cars and everything. You know, taken to Charlottesville and not given a fair trial in my judgment, under an unconstitutional statute in my judgment. And he served his time and he came back and he wanted to finish his PhD. He got brought before the Student Conduct Committee there. And there was some exchange beforehand. And, you know, in this day and age, especially at the PhD level, you don't really need to show up on campus, right? Especially in this COVID environment. So he said, look, you know, I won't get within 100 miles of campus. So he was brought before this Student Conduct Committee that consisted of a black woman, a Hispanic woman, and an Asian woman.
Right, like how fair are they going to be to him? Yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine if it was reversed? You know, and they found that he's still a threat to the campus. and this is from the same California system that has allowed in, you know, second degree murderers, most of whom are minority, and other protesters, and I mean the record is really completely inconsistent on this. It's also the system where I believe Angela Davis, you're not old enough to remember Angela Davis, but she was part of the violent, some of the violent civil rights groups back in, wouldn't call them civil rights group, but violent groups back in the 60s and 70s. And I think she got convicted of providing a weapon to a guy who killed a federal judge. And she's teaching there and they're lecturing us about him being a threat to the student campus. But anyway, it got reviewed and of course it got approved. So if we can raise the resources, we'd like to bring a First Amendment retaliation claim against UCLA. And just to allow him to finish his PhD.
Right, yeah. From what I understand, he only had, what, 1 year left to go to actually complete the degree? And he wouldn't even have had to physically be on campus to complete it. Is that also correct?
That's true. So true.
Yeah, so, I mean, talk about, again, totally politically motivated, this sort of persecution. There's no other way of looking at this. So, well, that's good. I mean, all three of these projects, I think, are very noble and certainly worth pursuing. And, of course, I wish you the best of luck and will do whatever I can to support you.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's – I mean, again, it's – this sort of organization, this sort of work that you're doing is so important when we are operating in basically hostile territory where the rule of law has been thrown out the window and is entirely – politically motivated and truly weaponized. And you know what? Before we wrap up, I got to get your take on some of these recent revelations about the very deep-rooted and quite systemic corruption at the FBI and, you know, some of these recent FBI whistleblower allegations, just totally exposing the politically motivated persecution of American dissidents and conservatives and the January 6th defendants, for example. And this is something that I mean, I think this the quote-unquote raid on Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence, you know, really sort of brought this to the limelight and it kind of woke up a lot of people like, wow, the FBI is totally criminal, as if they needed another reminder after years of Russiagate and all this other nonsense. But it's just so obvious now, especially under Biden, that the FBI has been weaponized by this administration. I mean, you could even make a strong case that the FBI and DOJ – were weaponized against President Trump during his own administration.
No, I call it the Federal Bureau of Intimidation. I've had several calls in the last month of people who've been visited by the FBI. And let me just apprise your readers generally that you have no obligation to talk to the FBI if they want to talk to you. Even if they arrest you, you have no obligation. Under Miranda, of course, you can keep silent and ask for your attorney. And certainly you don't have any obligation when they're not arresting you and they have nothing, but they want to talk to you. And they usually show up as a duo, and that's because they're taking notes secretly or they're going to go back. And if there's only one of you and there's two of them, well, they can say you said things. So I don't see any benefit to talking to the FBI. I don't know. A lot of these have come my way recently. The FBI is part of the Justice Department, which is run by Mr. Garland, who has declared that the greatest threat to democracy is white supremacy, as he defines it. And it's defined in a way that anybody who's not ashamed to be European is a white supremacist. So that it's corrupt all the way to the top. And the FBI seems to be almost like a janissary, just serving these elites at the top. And they're pulling resources off of other things. Why aren't they pursuing, I asked rhetorically, the people who went to Epstein's Island, you know, and the big shots that he was influencing with young women? I would think that would be something the FBI might spend some time on, but they don't seem to have the resources because they want to pull it all on this supposed white supremacist threat.
Yeah, it's a joke, and that's something that Biden and his entire administration have been running with from day one, largely using this totally asinine narrative that January 6th was an insurrection, you know, spearheaded and led by domestic terrorists and extremists and white supremacists, these very weaponized buzzwords that have been thrown out there. And people are seeing through this. And in fact, there have even been a number of FBI whistleblowers that have come out over the course of the past few months, just totally exposing what the FBI is up to and the, you know, the politically motivated nature of everything that they're involved with, especially the January 6th prosecutions. Did you read anything, any of the allegations by FBI Special Agent Steve Friend? His last name is Friend. Maybe he's like a distant relative or something. I'm not sure, but this guy worked for the FBI. He was a 12-year FBI veteran and also apparently was a SWAT team member. I believe he worked in Florida and had been complaining to his supervisors about some of the violations that he was witnessing in his day-to-day, his day-to-day work. Let me just read you briefly some of the major allegations that he made. He basically said that the Washington, D.C. field office is manipulating FBI case management protocol and farming out January 6th cases to field offices across the country to create the false impression that right-wing domestic violence is a widespread national problem that goes far beyond the quote-unquote black swan event of January 6th. So he's saying, as a result, he was listed as lead agent in cases he had not investigated and which his supervisor had not signed off on in direct violation of FBI policy. He said that the FBI domestic terrorism cases are being opened on innocent American citizens who were nowhere near the Capitol on January 6th based on anonymous tips to an FBI hotline or from Facebook spying on their messages.
So talk about,
I mean, this is like straight out of like what you would read about in the Soviet Union.
Oh my God. Yeah. Think back to Hale Cusinelli. I mean, they interviewed 44 people just to get conviction of one guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have mixed feelings about these whistleblowers. I assume if they blow the whistle, they leave the FBI, which just leaves all the corrupt people there without any honest people. I would hope they would stay.
I know a couple of the guys that I've been reading about have been – I don't know if they're still actually working for the FBI. I mean, basically, if you come out and you start exposing this stuff, you're going to eventually get either fired or dismissed or run out of the agency essentially. Dan Bongino, I don't know if you follow him all that closely. He's actually got a pretty decent radio show. Yeah, the Dan Bongino show. He's on Fox News quite a bit. He's pretty good. I think he's a pretty good reporter anyways. He interviewed another FBI whistleblower who I believe is one of the main whistleblowers that was going directly to Congress and providing, for example, like Representative Jim Jordan with information. And, you know, these Congress people get up and, you know, they have these committee hearings and they invite like Christopher Wray to come and testify. And they just all the FBI officials just totally stonewall these members of Congress, showing nothing but contempt and just, you know, essentially hatred for any form of like accountability. Like they're just above everything. It is so outrageous, which is why this organization needs to be totally disbanded. And I'm skeptical of anybody saying anything other than that. There is no reforming this organization. There is no reining it in. There is no, you know, this is an organization that is criminal to its core. It is totally political. And frankly, in my opinion, it needs to go. Yeah. But,
You know, it behaves so much like the SPLC. And I mean, and it's, you know, exaggeration of the dissident rights, wrong deeds, and ignoring those of others, which made me wonder if there was some affiliation. But yeah, a little internet search said that the FBI had, there's strong evidence that they've been, you know, cooperating with the SPLC. And my God.
I mean, oh, yeah. Well, they cooperate with the SPLC. They cooperate with the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, these are hardly objective, professional, unbiased organizations, right? Yeah. I mean, they very much have a political agenda. And these whistleblowers, I mean, most of the allegations center around manipulating information, manipulating evidence, and sort of mischaracterizing January 6th cases to basically bolster this fake political narrative about the threat of white supremacy and this sort of thing. Another guy that I read in the Washington Times, he was basically saying that most of these counterterrorism cases pursued by the FBI, specifically against quote-unquote right-wing extremists, amounted to entrapment. Yeah. And this is something the FBI has been doing for decades, and it was most recently on display with the Gretchen Whitmer alleged kidnapping, where literally that entire case was concocted and advanced and totally manufactured by FBI agents or informants or basically people that were connected to the FBI, people that were getting paid by the FBI to push this quote-unquote conspiracy.
So true.
You know, I mean, this is what the FBI is up to.
Yeah. By the way, John, did you know that when the FBI was formed in 1908 as an investigative unit of the Department of Justice, there were 35 of them, and now there are 35,000 or more. So it's grown 1,000 times in 112 years.
Oh, that's, I believe it. It's just like the U.S. national debt. Yeah. I mean, it's just been increasing almost exponentially, but especially since 9/11, it's gone up from like I think $5 or $6 trillion dollars to now it's like over $31 trillion in debt. You know, it's just outrageous. So anytime these federal entities are created and established, and then they manufacture a crisis like 9/11, it's just ripe for exploitation and corruption and everything that comes with it. I got to ask you one last question. House Republicans are attempting to, and I sort of alluded to this previously, they're attempting to rein in the FBI and the DOJ with strict oversight and new laws. I just read an article in the Washington Times the other day, and some of these congressional Republicans are attempting to, create new laws and new guidelines and policies to what they believe to maybe rein in the FBI. I'm very, very skeptical that there will be any reining in of the FBI. It has to be totally dismantled, and the criminals in charge of it need to be prosecuted, frankly. That's the only way to actually deal with this problem and to straighten out our justice system. But how much hope do you have for House Republicans to actually rein in the FBI? Do you think it's even possible at this point?
I don't. Rein it in. I'm sorry. I do think they could. I don't think they could abolish it, John. I wish it were possible. I mean, the FBI does other things, like not as much as we'd like. I mean, they do investigate. I hope they investigate like fentanyl conspiracy and drug rings and things like that. So there's and they are friends, as you say, with the SPLC and the ADL, who would have a strong voice. But I would hope that, you know, it's funny about so many of these things. They have a momentum that they just keep going until they can't go any farther. And I think the corruption in the FBI has gone to that point where even maybe moderate Republicans want to do something about it, and they're not powerless. So I don't think there would be any radical changes, but I do think there could be some favorable changes. I am hopeful of that. By the way, I know it's diverging, but I'm a little hopeful that there might be some pushback on this tech censorship. There's an opinion that came out of the Fifth Circuit down in Texas that upheld the Texas law that any thing like Twitter or social media that has over 50 million can't censor based on viewpoint.
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah, that was the Texas Attorney General, I believe, that that fought that lawsuit and actually won in state court. Anyways, we'll see. From what I understand, it's going to wind up, going to the Supreme Court.
It is.
Yeah. So that's certainly a step in the right direction. I mean, anytime whether it's the Texas Attorney General or you with the Free Expression Foundation or anybody stands up and challenges these people, that certainly is a good thing. At least there's some pushback and there's some fight left. I mean, that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely a step in the right direction. As far as the FBI being reined in, I am, as I said, very, very skeptical, but I certainly hope so. I hope somebody can get this organization under control. Although at this point, I kind of doubt it.
Yeah.
But I understand the point you're making. I think it would be incredibly difficult for, to muster the political willpower to actually abolish the FBI.
Well, if Trump got in, that's one thing. As I said, they keep pushing, and they've finally pushed so far that they've censored Trump. I mean, that's what put in mind this Texas law. I think that was a bridge too far when they started pushing Trump off Twitter or something. And I mean, Trump obviously doesn't like the FBI. If he got reelected, I think there might be some. I don't know though. I don't know how these things work internally. And as you say, we have mixed feelings about Trump, but he's certainly not a friend to the FBI, I don't think, at this point. So.
Right. All right, Glenn. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, sir. I really appreciate it. This went a little bit longer than I was anticipating, but that's okay. It was a good conversation, I think. Your organization is the Free Expression Foundation. That's freeexpressionfoundation.org. So do be sure to check it out and support your work if you can.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Okay. Yes. Yep. Thank you, Glenn. I appreciate it. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, John. Thank you.
Okay. Take care, man.
Bye.